Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, welcome to the Daily Jungle. It is finally official. Floyd v. Conor is happening, and each of these guys are going to make serious nine-figure jack or more. I give you my take on that fight. The Clippers landed the logo. Steve Ballmer gets his guy by bringing Jerry West back to L.A. And we had three awesome guests as well. Former MLB'er Rick Ankiel was an excellent conversation. New Ohio State basketball coach Chris Holtman came in. And Yahoo's Kevin Ioli broke down Mayweather v. McGregor. And he flexed his muscles with some Pittsburgh Penguins Stanley Cup championship knowledge. All that and Alvy's four-day week that was. That's right, clones. Once again, it is my Friday. So, Alvy, do what you do best. It is on. After what felt like years of talking, Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor are finally going to fight each other. It is official, and it's going to take place in Las Vegas on August 26th. Here are the details. 12 rounds, boxing at 154 pounds with 10-ounce gloves. But here is the detail that matters the most. Half a billion dollars and maybe more than that, with each guy reportedly expected to take home 100 mil each. There's your bottom line. That's the only deet that really matters. Now, on the one hand, I could argue that I never thought this would happen. Never thought it would happen on the one hand because Floyd was retired. Conor had never boxed. Therefore, it can't happen. Then again, given how much money was on the table, it couldn't not happen. And here we are. Here the bleep we are. And if you want to know how that promotion is going to go, all you had to do was check Conor's Twitter feed within moments of the announcement. He tweeted, "The fight is on," with a photo of himself and one of Floyd Mayweather. Not Floyd Mayweather Jr., Floyd Mayweather Sr., the 64-year-old trainer who has not fought in nearly three decades. As in, I got this because Mayweather is old as hell. That's a 10-8 round for Conor. And proof that the promotion for the event's going to be awesome. The press conferences, the interviews, the tweets, they'll all be electric. Better than the fight. Hell, Conor's first tweet is probably going to be better than the fight. The fight will be great until they actually step into the ring. Because as much as I like and respect Conor, and he is one of my favorite athletes ever, as much as I like and respect him, I don't see how he wins this fight, of course. I mean, yes, Floyd is 40, 12 years older than Conor, but does Floyd look like a guy who's let himself go? Does he look like a guy who's out of shape? Ever? Sure, Floyd hasn't stepped into a boxing ring for a year and a half, but Conor has not stepped into a boxing ring ever. Floyd is 49-0. Conor is 0-0. Floyd has beaten the likes of Oscar De La Hoya, Manny Pacquiao, Juan Manuel Marquez, Shane Mosley, Canelo Alvarez, and more. Conor's next punch in a boxing match is going to be his first. Floyd, one of the greatest boxers ever. Crazy fast hands, incredible footwork, and a remarkable defense. He's been boxing since he was a kid. He stepped in against the best fighters of his era. And not only have they not beaten him, they've barely touched him. And now you have an MMA guy who just started boxing, just now is taking up the sport, and he's going to succeed where every other great boxer failed. Come on.
Come on.
No, not come on. Come on. Floyd's already the heavy betting favorite, and he should be. He has to be. He has to win the fight. Not just for himself, but for the entire sport of boxing. Losing to Conor would be such a terrible look for Floyd and for the entire sport. Can you imagine what that would look like if guys like Manny and Canelo couldn't even lay a glove on Floyd, but Conor rolls right in and beats him in his first boxing match ever? That would be brutal. And the sport of boxing, boxing fans, and Floyd would never hear the end of it because Conor wouldn't let them. So, why is Conor taking a fight that he really doesn't have a chance to win? He's got 100 million reasons to take that fight. In fact, he's already won. And then there's that other part of the fight. The fact that everybody's saying, oh, I'm not doing this. I'm not a party of this. I'm not going to buy this. Everyone who says that they don't want to shell out for a fight that has no chance of being competitive, you know, especially since the pay-per-view is going to be so steep. no way am I putting out that kind of money for a fight that's going to be like most of Floyd's fights. Him dancing around for 12 rounds, then raising his hand at the end. That makes sense.
Yeah, and can I say something? I get that, sort of on some level. I also know it's garbage. And you should know it's garbage. You'll watch it. You know you will. Everybody will. Because it's the only thing people will be talking about the week before and the Monday after. And you don't want to be the only slug who missed it in the event that something dramatic does happen. And you got to admit, the timing is perfect. Right in August, before football starts. In that dead zone. After the smack off and before kickoff. So you're not going to miss it, because deep down, there is a part of you that wonders, what will it look like? What will it be like if Conor actually does do the one thing that nobody else has been able to do? Land that one big shot that does put Floyd to sleep. Because as Dana White likes to say, when Conor hits people, they go down. And on the off chance that that happens here, and Conor somehow miraculously shocks the world and beats Floyd, then look the hell out. And the thing about Conor, the cat really does think he can win. He really does. And then again, why wouldn't he? Fact is, even if he loses, he's already won. This guy was a plumber's apprentice about a decade ago. Now he sits atop the entire sporting world, in line for a $100 million payday. And the fact that this guy talked his way into that payday is utterly brilliant. Like, I'm not saying that he talked his way into the champion that he is. He earned that. But he did talk his way into this fight. And if you want to be the only one on the planet who misses it in the event that Floyd does shock the world, that's on you. But you're watching it, and you know you are. Can I tell you something? I am, and I'm not ashamed to say it. I'm into it. Know exactly what you're signing up for, and then you cannot be disappointed. Go in with your eyes wide open. Understand it for what it is. It's an event. It's a spectacle. It's something different. It's the circus. I'm in. I'm in. I'm not ashamed to say it. I'm in. 1-800-636-8686. I said earlier this morning on K-Rock, I mean, as a kid, you loved circus, right? This is the adult version thereof. It's Lobster Boy. It's the Bearded Lady. Who doesn't like the circus? Kevin Ioli is all over this story. Kevin, it's so good to have you back on. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Good to hear from you again.
You too, Kevin. Always good to have you on this show. Thanks for doing it. It is official. Floyd and Conor are going to fight on August 26th in Vegas. Kevin, it feels like we've been talking about this for an eternity. Did you think that this would ever really happen?
You know, Jim, I thought it probably would happen, but I thought that this thing would go a lot longer than it did. I'm really shocked that they got it together as quickly as they did. You know, the Pacquiao-Mayweather negotiations, you know, nothing's ever going to top that. But that went on for 5.5, nearly 6 years. And I thought we were going to be in for, you know, an 18-month type deal with this one before it happened. I figured there was a good chance it would happen because so much money is involved in it. But the speed of how quickly they got it done, and really that one caught me by surprise.
Kevin Ioli joining us. So the argument then also, Kevin, is it couldn't not happen because there's so much money involved. How much money is involved? How big is this thing, and how much money might we be talking about?
Well, let's do a little comparison. I mean, the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight sold $4.6 million on pay-per-view. It had an overall gross of a little over $600 million. The paid gate, the ticket price, was $72 million. They set records in virtually every area, and I think this fight is going to approach that fight. I think $500 million would be a conservative estimate for the gross in the fight. Floyd and Conor both are going to be looking at nine-figure paydays. You know, Floyd, I would assume bigger than Conor. They haven't talked about the split yet, and I've been working on finding that out, but I haven't at this point. But however it goes down, both guys are going to make massive amounts of money. The promoters are going to make a lot of money, and Showtime's going to come out of this looking very well, too.
Kevin Ioli is a combat sports writer for Yahoo Sports. Now, Kevin, Bob Bennett is the executive director of the Nevada Athletic Commission, and as you write, his job is to approve fights, and he's turned down a number of fights because of mismatches. I could certainly argue that there's no greater mismatch than a guy who's 49-0 taking on a guy who's 0-0. So what sold Bennett on this fight?
Well, I had two stories yesterday where I quoted him on different things. And, you know, he said Connor's bigger, he's younger. He pointed to Floyd's layoff. And he also pointed to the fact that Bob Arum and Oscar, you know, wanted to put their guys in against Connor. So he said that gave credibility to the fact that Connor, you know, was good enough to fight a boxer. You know, I think Bob Bennett is in probably the worst situation of anybody in this, because here's what would happen, Jim, and you know this and I know this. If he would have turned it down, which he could have done rightly, saying Conor McGregor has had no experience, how do you have an 0-0 guy fight a 49-0 guy? If he would have turned it down, the promoters would have gone to the head of the athletic commission. And for some reason, if the head of the athletic commission didn't overrule his executive director, they would have went to Governor Brian Sandoval, and Governor Brian Sandoval would have told everybody, make it happen. So really, Bennett had no choice in the matter. I mean, you know, he's kind of the figurehead, and he's going to be the guy that gets beaten up, but at the end of the day, this went far beyond him.
Clones, let me get at you for a moment about Stamps.com. Stamps.com saves you time and money, which you can use to grow your business. I can mail any letter, any package, using just my computer and printer, and the mailman picks it right up. I can avoid the hassle of the post office and mail everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international. Stamps.com makes it so easy. They'll send you a digital scale, automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com. We will help you decide the very best class of mail based on your needs. There is no need to lease an expensive postage meter. Don't do that. I use Stamps.com because I'm never going to the post office again, ever. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the very top of the homepage. Type in Rome. Stamps.com. Enter Rome. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office ever again. That's Stamps.com. Now back to the Daily Jungle. 100%. Kevin Ioli joining us. Now, all of that said, and I agree with everything you just said, one of the things that Bennett did talk about was the fact that he watched video of Connor from a recent sparring session, and he says he was impressed by how much he had improved in the past 6 months. What do you make of that, and how much could he have really have improved over that stretch of time?
Yeah, you know, he might have improved a lot, but you're talking about a guy starting from zero trying to get to 100, and Floyd Mayweather has been at 100 for 20 years. So, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, the thing is that people who don't follow MMA closely have to understand, when you maybe turn on TV and you're flipping the channels and you see an MMA fight on, and you might look and think that the MMA fighter's technique is poor. It's not poor. They are defending more things than a boxer defends, so they can't take the same stance that a boxer uses. They have to defend takedowns and kicks and elbows and knees and punches and all sorts of things. So they have to take a different stance, because these are two different sports. They're similar but different. And so as a result, you know, I think that it's just, you know, one of those things that Connor's just not going to be a skilled boxer in this thing. His hope is going to be he can get Mayweather in a corner, have him where he doesn't have an escape route, and land a big shot on him. The trouble that he faces in that gym, as you well know, is that some of the best boxers of the last quarter century have tried that on Floyd and weren't successful.
Kevin, I only my guess, without question, Kevin. Now, what about this? I mean, he does have great punching power. He's got this great ability to strike. But how does Connor's punching power as an MMA fighter compare to the punching power of a boxer?
You know, that is a good question, and that's one I have thought about over the last 48 hours, and I don't have a good answer for that. My sense is that not as good for a couple reasons. Number one, I think it's technique. You know, the boxers are in tighter, and they've learned how to throw. You know, MMA fighters tend to throw wider punches because of the stance they're in. They generate a lot of force with that, but boxers will see that come and be able to get out of the way of it. You know, so I would probably guess, you know, lean toward the side of saying not. Also, remember, in MMA, Connor is wearing 4-ounce gloves. Now they're going to be, because they're fighting at 154, they're going to 10-ounce gloves. So 2.5 times bigger. And while, you know, some people might say, and I know Dana White's made the argument, that it will help Connor's wrist and he'll be able to follow through more and he'll actually be more powerful with the 10-ounce glove than the 4-ounce glove, I don't buy that argument. You know, Dana's one of the best promoters of all time, and he's trying to sell his guys chances in the fight. I just think Conor's not going to hit as hard in the boxing matches he did in MMA. And that, you know, one of his big things in MMA, too, is he's got great kicks, and he hurts people with kicks to set up his punches, and he's going to lose that here as well.
We're talking to Kevin Ioli for a few more moments. All right, Kevin, then what about the other side of that? How do Floyd's punches compare with some of the shots that Conor has taken in the octagon?
You know, I think Floyd is a sharp puncher and not a vicious Mike Tyson knockout puncher. But Floyd, you're not going to want to rush in on a guy like Floyd because he will hit you with that right hand. You saw what he did to Victor Ortiz. I don't think Conor it has to worry too much about Floyd's one-punch punching power, though. You know, he's gotten hit by some good shots that I think, you know, would be comparable. But where I think Conor's going to have trouble is he may not see these punches coming because Floyd is brilliant at angles and at footwork and moving you to where he wants you to be. And if you're not really astute at boxing and you haven't really done that, you know, he'll walk you to a place where you don't know you're going, and all of a sudden he throws a right hand from a spot you don't see it coming. And that's where it could hurt him.
All right, so you mentioned Ortiz. Mayweather has not knocked out anybody since he finished Victor Ortiz in the fourth round, but that was when Ortiz dropped his guard. He hasn't really knocked out anybody since Ricky Hatton, and that was nearly 10 years ago. Do you think that he would try to knock McGregor out, or is he going to be happy to go 12 rounds with him?
I think he really needs to knock him out. I mean, I think, you know, Floyd is all about winning the fight and not putting himself at risk. And that 49-0 record means a lot to him. And so 50-0 means a tremendous amount to him. So I don't think he's going to take an excessive risk to go do it. But I think if he's in the second half of the fight and, you know, he's cutting up Conor and he kind of feels like he's got the timing down and he understands, you know, what Conor is trying to accomplish, I think you might see then Floyd stand a little more flat-footed and throw those right hands at him to try to get him out of there. I think there's a chance that in the second half of the fight, Floyd could swell up Conor's eyes, could cut him, and could stop him that way. You know, I wouldn't expect him to put him down for a 10 count, but I do think he could go out there and stop him just by, you know, accumulation of punches to the face.
Kevin, one last stop before you go. You and I have talked in the past about this, but the promotion for the fight is going to be incredible. Conor already started with those tweets about how old Floyd is. What do you think that Floyd is going to make of Conor's approach at the press conference? And is there any way Conor can get into Floyd's head the way he has so many other guys?
Floyd is a genius at getting into the other guy's head, but this is one where I think Conor has the advantage, Jim. And I think that Conor, you know, Floyd has never encountered anybody like Conor. And Conor, he's not going to care and respect Floyd. He's not going to thank him for the payday, which so many of Floyd's previous opponents did. And he's not going to treat him deferentially. You know, he's going to mock him just like he did. And I think that, you know, that will have some impact on Floyd. I don't think it's going to totally throw Floyd off because he's such a pro and he's been around so long. But I don't think Floyd's going to be able to kind of do his mind games and get into Conor's head because he's going to be defending more than he's going to be on offense.
Kevin, do you think after the fight, do you think that Conor returns to the UFC or does he just take that giant paycheck and just go home?
You know, my contention, and I wrote this earlier, I said I think if the fight happens, it would be his last fight. Dana White said yesterday he talked to Conor in the morning and that Conor said he wants to defend the UFC title again. But look, you know, you saw, just like I did, the Forbes list of the 100 top paid athletes. Conor was, I think, number 24, 25, and he had purse of, you know, total money made of $35 million, and that included two fights. So $7 million in there was endorsement money. So now he's making, just in purse, he's going to make over $100 million. What is the incentive for him to go through this training camp? His girlfriend just had a baby. Why put yourself through this again after you've been it when you finally hit the top and, you know, you're never going to do better than this? So he's a crazy competitor, and Dana swears up and down that he thinks Conor will come back to fight, but I just don't know that he's going to have the incentive to do that.
Kevin, last thought. I can't let you go without talking some hockey with you, because as some people know, you are a huge Penguins fan. What was this postseason like for you then, and what do you make of the toughness of that team?
You know, the Penguins were incredible this year because not only did they lose Chris Letang, their best defenseman and one of the best in the NHL, and they played with, you know, really pedestrian guys the rest of the way on defense. They had injuries up and down the lineup. During the regular season, they were battered. I think they had more man games lost than any other team, and then they played with these massive amounts of injury. But I think what it showed is, you know, Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin are such special players, and they've kind of matured into their roles now. Earlier in their career, you know, they had that drought where after winning the one cup, they went a few years without winning again. And I think they learned what it takes to win. And the Penguins have put the right players around them. They have the great cast of complementary players, and they follow Sid's lead. And this was, even though I think by far this is the least talented of the Penguins' five Stanley Cup championship teams, in my mind, it was the most fun to watch.
I had to ask you about that.
Here in Los Angeles, the LA Clippers just had one of their best days ever. They may be getting themselves a brand new arena, and weird as it sounds, it looks as if they have hired away the ultimate Laker, Jerry West. So that's a very good day. If Jerry West can talk Chris Paul out of bouncing for San Antonio and staying here in LA, that alone is worth whatever they're paying him. In terms of a potential new arena in Inglewood, I'm sure Steve Ballmer and the Clippers feel like second-class citizens at Staples, because that's exactly what they are. Second-class citizens. They're the JV. That's not their house. They're crashing on somebody else's couch. It looks bad, and I'm guessing it feels worse, and Ballmer did not drop two bills on that team so he could squat in somebody else's house. Of course the guy wants his own joint, and given how much he's worth and the fact that he can finance that whole thing by himself, he's going to get it. And if I'm a Clipper fan, I'm celebrating like Ballmer at a Microsoft event.
Yes!
We're joined by Rick Ankiel. Rick, it is really nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
Good, good, Rick. Rick, your story to me is amazing. It's been an incredible journey. And you had offers to write a book when you were still playing, even have your story turn into a movie, but you turned them down then. So what made you feel like now is the right time to share your story?
Well, the first thing is that I felt like it would have been a distraction if I was still in uniform. I just wasn't ready to go that route, and I didn't want the more publicity or more of my attention going to something beyond trying to perform on the field. The second thing is I wouldn't have been able to open up like I did. And once I retired, you know, I looked back on what I went through pitching, the control stuff, and I couldn't find a lot of literature on it. Nobody really wanted to talk about it, and I don't have an issue talking about it. And I understand that my voice can help other people, whether it be in baseball or athletics or, you know, in a different profession. So if my voice can inspire somebody, I figured the timing was right, and why not do it?
Good for you. Both those things make perfect sense to me. Now, you were the high school player of the year at Port St. Lucie High School, and you were dominant then, and then that continued when you were the top prospect in minors or in the minors. So what was your life like at that point?
Oh, I was living the dream. I mean, you know, my goal as a young man and young player was to be one of the greatest pitchers that ever played, and certainly everything leading up to that point, all the media attention I was getting, the way I was performing on the field, everything was pointing towards I was headed to that destiny. And I felt invincible. I mean, year after year, I was getting better, learning how to pitch, and things were going awesome.
Things were going awesome, and the dream was taking form, but the truth is you did not have an easy childhood at all. Your father was an alcoholic and a drug abuser. He was arrested more than a dozen times. So how were you able to maintain your focus on the field? And then what was life like for you and your mother growing up?
Life was tough. You know, I come from a dysfunctional home, and really, you know, baseball was the thing that saved me. It was, you know, one of the things I was good at even from a young age, and it was where I would go to find peace. And in a lot of ways, baseball saved me, because I would leave home and you know, think about, hey, I'm going to the field and I'm going to have fun and be great today. And you know, it was hard. I wish, you know, I think it was harder on my mom, and I wish for her that she would have had a better life. And I can see the effects even today that it's left with her. And you know, I don't wish that on anybody. And my heart goes out to other people who've grown up in similar situations. And like I said, baseball was my safe place and where I went to have fun and enjoy life.
How about this? The one thing you didn't mention, number one, it was not that bad of a pitch. But number two, the thing that you didn't mention, Mike Matheny, who was the team's regular catcher, was not in that game at that point. What if he had been? Would he have caught that ball? And would this be a totally different story?
You know, I think he probably catches that pitch, but I don't know. Does it happen on another pitch? I mean, it's one of those things that will never be able to be answered. And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I hope that, you know, I've spoke about it with Mike, and he carries a little bit of guilt. He feels like he could have just done more for me. But I don't want him to feel that way. And who knows when or if this would have happened. There's just no telling. I mean, for me, not only to move forward, but looking back on it, you know, it's just one of those things that did happen. It didn't matter why it happened at the time. It was just the way I looked at it was, I don't care why it happened. I just want to know how to fix it. And how do I deal with this on a daily basis back to who I was?
I was going to say, so then how do you go about doing that? For instance, you always had this great, great work ethic, and you would try to work your way through anything, grind through it. And I would imagine that's the way you went about it, right? You put even more time into it. How did that go?
You're exactly right. I was a perfectionist, and I felt like I could outwork anything. There's no question about it. I looking back now, I don't think that was the right recipe because, you know, I'm out there. I feel like, you know, I had the cinder wall block wall behind my house. And I'd watch TV and I'd see somebody else throwing. And it would just make me start thinking about my own throwing. I'd go out there, I'd throw 100 balls, 200 balls. And I just couldn't stop. I'd go in, something else would happen. And I'd think, you know what, maybe I'll try holding my arm a little higher this time. And it was this revolving door that would never let go. And I just kept trying to outthrow it and outthrow it. And then you find something that works, the mechanical clue, let's say. And then I go to the field, and it might work for one day. And then the next day, it just all falls apart. And it just seems like you try so many different things that by the time you're done, you don't even remember how to get back to square one. And now you're more lost than you were before. The one thing it did, though, I started to realize it's not mechanical. This is mental, and even though I felt like I could fix it mechanically, I just couldn't because the mental side of it makes your mechanics break down, your brain and your arm. I mean, your brain just takes over and won't allow you to do things that you've always done.
Rick Ankiel joining us. I'm going to ask you about Harvey Dorfman in 1 minute, but when you talk about that it starts to affect your relationships with your friends, your family, there are dark times. I mean, the fact is you started to use alcohol and pot to try to cope. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. You know, the pot, at first it started to help with the anxiety. And then what I found was it really started to make me overthink things and overanalyze things. And instead of making the anxiety go away, it made it magnify. And I realized, okay, well, this isn't working. I started drinking more than I was before just to forget because, like I said, the anxiety, the thoughts of how you're going to fix it and whatever just consume you. And I couldn't get away from it. I was just tired of thinking about it. And, you know, you go out and you have beers and all of a sudden now you're going out more than you're used to just try to forget this stuff. And I even tried pitching bus, you know, in 2001, that first start, I faced Randy Johnson. And I'd say a couple weeks before that, somebody casually mentioned, hey, maybe you should try pitching bus. Maybe that'll work. And I laughed at it. Whatever. And then the morning of that game in 2001, I wake up. And this is hours before the game. And the anxiety that I'm feeling is immense and through the roof. And the closer it got to the game, the worse it got. I get to the field. I tell Daryl Kyle, hey, listen, there's no way I'm going to be successful. You think you can go get me a bottle of liquor and put it in a water bottle? He goes, look, I understand. You got to do what you got to do. I'll make it happen. And I pitched that game, Buzz, and I ended up beating Randy Johnson. I remember telling Harvey Dorfman, who was my sports psychologist at the time, after the game, hey, I had to pitch Buzz to make it through that game, but it worked. And I remember him saying to me, listen, I understand what you did, but I want you to know it's not real. And I felt like, what's not real? I just beat Randy Johnson. The box score is real. The win I have next to my name is real. And I didn't embarrass myself, and we won. So I try it the next game, and all of a sudden, you know, the anxiety was so powerful, it just overcame the alcohol, and I knew that that wasn't the answer, and I had to face it head on.
That is an absolutely amazing story. Rick Ankiel joining us. So, Rick, when your agent Scott Boris called you and said, hey, what do you think about playing the outfield? What was your reaction?
At first, I thought he was crazy. I'm like, are you not listening to me? Like, did you not hear that I just retired? I mean, I just retired an hour before that. I quit pitching, walked into Tony Luce's office and said, look, I'm done. I get home. He calls and, you know, says, hey, what do you think about being an outfielder? And I was like, are you serious right now? So it took me a minute. I said, listen, I got to think about this. It just took me – it was the hardest decision I ever had to make was to give up pitching, the only dream I ever wanted. For me to feel like I'm going to fall back in love with baseball and give this a shot. And at the time, this was kind of an unheard-of thing. You know, organizations didn't give people these kind of chances. So I hang up. I think about 4 or 5 hours go by, and I'm just trying to visualize what I think this would be like and what I think it's going to take. And finally, I get to the point where I envision myself getting back to the big league and hitting a home run as a position player. And as soon as I felt, imagine what that would feel like, I picked up the phone, called Scott back. He says, all right, let me call the Cardinals. About 2 minutes later, my phone rings. It's Walt Jocherty, who was the general manager of the Cardinals at the time. He says, hey, listen, if you want to try this, we're in 100%. If you want to do it, show up tomorrow, and we'll give you the opportunity to try to make it back as an outfielder.
Rick, I got about 90 seconds before the segment's over, but I have to ask, you visualized it, and then in your first game back in the majors in 07, you come to the plate in the seventh inning, two out, two on, you hit the ball. I mean, you jumped ship. You did exactly what you visualized. What was it like to have that happen and to get that curtain call?
Oh, it was so incredible. I mean, as soon as I realized it was a home run, I was about halfway to first. I had this explosion of emotions go through me. It was magical. I felt like I floated around the bases on a magic carpet. I couldn't feel my legs. The standing ovation, everybody going crazy in the dugout, including Tony La Russa, which we never see him act emotional. It's something I wish I could share with everybody how I felt, but just one of those magical, incredible moments that I will never, ever forget.
Right, so last thought, you've been through some amazing and challenging times. As a result, what have you learned about yourself, and what would you say to somebody who's having a hard time in their life right now?
I would say no matter what happens in your life, you can always improve the quality of your life. For me, I look at it like all the things that I've been through. I'm so proud of the person that I am today from where I was. Just keep going after it. Each day is a new day. The sun will rise tomorrow. So no matter what you're going through, there's always a chance to get better.
Deitch in Oakland. He calls from the parade. Deitch, what's going on? How's your day going?
What's happening, partner?
What's up, Deitch?
What's happening, partner?
Rory, can you hear me? What's happening, partner?
Yeah, I got the first what's happening, partner. Can you hear me? Deitch.
I got you now. I got you. It's loud out here, man. It's crazy. We're at the parade. Where is Zenless even from? I think they've even put the city down. Are you kidding me with that garbage? Right now, I'm on Broadway. Can you hear me? It's a little bit loud out here.
No, you know what, Deitch, I hear you fine. I hear nothing else but you. You sound great. So talk to me.
Right,
what's it like? What's it like out there? What's your day been like?
Oh, man, it's so awesome. Everybody's so happy. People have been lining up since 5 a.m. I'm a bar right here on Broadway. And, man, it's been so good. Draymond just came by in his own bus. He's smoking a cigar. We had Matty Barnes go by. We're waiting for the next big bus to go by. Must be a million people out here, Romy.
Deitch, let me ask you something. I'm glad that you made that call. It's great that you could set the scene. Have you seen any of the following? What did the mayor present Steve Kerr with a crowbar to the city? Did that happen?
She did not present Steve Kerr with a crowbar to the city yet. But you know what, Romy? I'll take Oakland's collective IQ against any other city here. And in anywhere else, anywhere in the jungle, Oakland has got it going on, man. We're so proud of this team. I know Smashville has got a great reputation for being an awesome hometown party team and a party city, but Oakland is going down right now, dude.
All right, Deitch, let me ask you something. You own a bar. Do you want to give the name of the bar, and is the bar open yet?
Bar is definitely open, man. We got a bar right here. It's on Broadway. It's called Miranda. Come on in, clones. We're having a good time. I wanted to tell you, Romy, you know, end of last year, Alvy, there was those dudes who came in and they were talking about Alvy and whether or not he had connections up in Oakland. And Alvy was like, no, I don't even know anybody in Oakland. And I was, so literally, is Alvy at work today, Romy?
He is. I'm looking right at him. You want to talk to him?
Let me tell you this, because last night I was in the bar, I was hanging out, and I had heard about this kid with these crazy moves crossing people over down at Mosswood Park at the local run. He was mixing them up. He was shooting. He was shucking. He was jiving. And the way that they were describing him was what I understood Alvy to look like. And I was like, man, that sounds crazy. This is Oakland, and I know Alvy may or may not have some people up here. So then at the bar around 10 o'clock last night, I see this dude, and I swear to God, I've never seen Alvy, but the way he was talking and the way he looked, he was like, I think that's Alvy. So then, boom, he orders up a shot of Jameson with a pickle back. And I'm like, oh, boy, here we go. He takes a shot, slams the pickle back, and he goes, this one's for Mill. And he runs outside, and this minivan pulls up. He jumps in and speeds off before I could even talk to him. Now, he, I guess, could have made it back to work today. Obviously, he's there. But that's what's going on in Oakland. Alvy has people up here. I swear I saw him.
Deitch in Oakland. Let me jump in on you, brother.
Brother.
As promised, we're joined right now by the head basketball coach at the Ohio State University. He was introduced as the new head coach on Monday. He was 70-31 in three seasons as the head coach at Butler. He led the Bulldogs to the NCAA tournament in each of his three seasons there. He previously spent three seasons as the head coach at Gardner-Webb. We are joined by Chris Holtman. Chris, nice to have you back. How are you?
Great to be with you, Jim. Hope you're doing well.
I am doing great. It's good to hear your voice. All right, so you are now the new head basketball coach at The Ohio State University. Chris, how does that sound to you, and what have the last few weeks been like for you and your family?
I tell you, Jim, it's been, you know, I'm getting used to it, right? I was telling somebody that, you know, when you jump into a job immediately once you're eligible, you know, you start making recruiting calls and, you know, you give your, obviously your name and then your title. And trust me, there's been a couple times where I've almost went wrong school. You know, I'm right. Still getting used to it. I'm excited about it. The last week was, this really last week's been unlike anything I've ever experienced. It happened really fast. Tuesday morning was the first time I was contacted, and it's been a whirlwind since then.
You know, it's amazing to see something that dramatic happen that quickly, Chris. Now, you had a very, very good thing going on at Butler. You had three straight tournament trips. You reached the Sweet 16 this year. It's a place where you were having a lot of success and could have had a lot more. So what was the opportunity, or what was it about the opportunity at Ohio State that appealed to you so much?
Well, I tell you, I deliberated on it, you know, for really as long as I could. As a matter of fact, part of, Wednesday, they wanted to meet. Gene Smith, the athletic director, wanted to meet, and I just wasn't ready. And that was just because of how I felt about the things we were doing at Butler. You know, we had three good years and finished with a tremendous year last year, the highest seed that Butler's ever had in the NCAA tournament. Had terrific kids, really good recruiting classes the last couple of years. And, you know, I had to take a step back and say, okay, do I want to leave that for a job that I think is one of the really special places in the country, but we've got some work to do at Ohio State, and we understand that, and we're excited about it. I think at the end of the day, Jim, I just was looking at it in its entirety and saying, you know, the kind of kids that I like to coach and I like to be around on a day-to-day basis, there's a lot of them in the breadbasket of Ohio State in the Columbus and Ohio and that area. And I looked at it as a tremendous opportunity, and obviously I'm following an outstanding coach, Thad.
You know, Chris, you and I have talked about this in the past, but if you go back a little, you resigned as the head coach at Gardner-Webb to be an assistant coach at Butler, so that tells you exactly how much you thought about Butler as a school and a program. Yeah. But as we have talked about in the past, you arrived there as an assistant, and then head coach Brandon Miller had to take that leave of absence, and then you take over. If we had spoken when you left Gardner-Webb, and I said that in 4 years you would be the head coach at Ohio State, what would you have said?
I'd probably tell you to put that flask down that you've been drinking too much. I would say, you know, it's I didn't obviously anticipate this. I really felt like, you know, when we were building that thing at Gardner-Webb and it was a rebuild, I really was, you know, I was sitting there saying, you know, I could do this for the next 10, 15 years. I could do this for a long time. I'm having so much fun. And yet when Brandon called and asked if I'd have interest in kind of helping him make the move to the Big East, I said, well, that sounds appealing. And I love the brand of Butler University, and, but I never envisioned this. It's such a different path, Jim, that, and I get that. And it's funny, I get that question a lot, and I realize it because it's a different path than most everybody else has taken that has gotten to this level. It's unique. I never planned it. Honestly, I was content to be, to be where I was at, but I feel incredibly blessed. And now, hopefully, I can take advantage of all these opportunities that have come my way, and that's what's put in front of us.
So let me ask you before you go. You mentioned that, you know, there's some challenges. You get an opportunity like this, it's going to come with some challenges. Does it feel like a long, slow rebuild, or is it something that you can turn around pretty quickly?
You know, I hope not. Obviously, I hope not. I do think there is some, there is some elements of that there's some things that we have to do here really in short order, Jim, to get it back to where Thad had it. And I'm still trying to diagnose it a little bit a week into the job and figure it out. But I'm hoping we can get there sooner than later. I do think we have some challenges ahead of us. The thing I do know, after being here for just a week, it's an incredible place. What Urban's done with the football program, obviously, and the education, it is an incredible place. And I've told people that, you know, I had other opportunities. But when I told my wife about this, she kind of took a deep breath, and because she knew there was gravity to it, and this was going to be a decision that I was probably going to make. And I'm excited about it. I'm excited about these next couple of years. We got some work ahead of us, but I love our kids right now, and I think we're getting to work.
And because today is my Friday, that means there's got to be a week that was. So in this case, the 4 days that were. Alvy, if it's not too much to ask, can you just go ahead and roll those 4 days back? What's going on? Welcome to the program. I am Jim Rome. We've got a great program. Lots to get to today. Right in the middle of Smack Off season. I've got to start first with the NHL Stanley Cup Final. Stop me if you've heard this one before. The Pittsburgh Penguins are tough as hell.
Yeah! It's all over! The Pittsburgh Penguins have won the Stanley Cup!
That's right.
I'm not ready to predict a three-peat, but after what I saw from this group over the last few months, I sure wouldn't rule that out either.
You can tell your mom! You can tell your pa!
And especially not when they are your first back-to-back champs in the salary cap era. Tom in Nashville.
I wake up and I live life here in Smashville. What a place to live. Penguin fan has to wake up and live their life in Pennsylvania's butthole.
There's got to be a better way to describe where somebody lives than by saying butthole.
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 Alvin, I didn't say you could do that. Howard Beck is my guest.
And by the way, Game Ops in Cleveland cranks that thing up like no other arena. They've got the volume on the sound system cranked up to an insane level.
Elk.
G'day, Jimmy. BBC's me, and the first thing I said to him, mate, can they keep it out of the hack? You know, can they keep it out of this deep muff? And he says, mate, there's more muff out here than a 1982 Hustler magazine.
Oh,
he said, what are we going with today? Muff, hippie hair, doesn't
hippie
matter.
We've done
it. Okay, let's go big hippie.
The Golden State Warriors are the 2017
I said before the series, the Warriors would win in five.
If we finish it tonight, get the Larry O.
And that makes two rings in 3 years. There's no reason to believe that this is going to change anytime soon.
I haven't had a beer since February.
Peter Guru, my guest.
We have an attitude of gratitude about getting where we are. We have to do what tomorrow's needs are. Other teams are getting better. We have to determine how we can get better. We always have to challenge our own incumbency. You know, it's a constant and never-ending change.
I have no reason to put my head down. I have no reason to look back at what I could have done.
To say that this guy's anything other than great, still on top of his game, it's just wrong. It's a whack take.
That's whack.
I'm heading to Siberia, trudging through the snow with a tree trunk on my back, grow out the beard and get ready to take on Lev, the Drago of the jungle. That is if, you know, Drago waxed his own body and distracted everyone from his weak takes with rabbit in the hat level gimmick.
He had Kale Shonen, and he had a partner. These were things that were not even thought of back in the day.
Not really true. Trapper and John in C-Town tried it back in the day.
These are greetings to you, Jimmy. Only six shopping days left to Christmas.
Bitch. I mean, what are you, the Grinch?
Here we go.
Not nearly as effective with it as Mike and Chael, but it's been done before. Chris Mannix joining us.
Just to editorialize for a quick second, this is a terrible fight. I hope it never happens. If it does happen, I'm not going to it. I don't want to go and see a farce of an exhibition between the best boxer in the world and a guy that's never boxed before.
Twitter. How's that Wisconsin muff? You know how I'm just going to take a beat or two or three or four or five so there's enough distance between those two things? 1-1000, 2-1000, now it's wet.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Scooter Jeanette joining us for another moment or so.
When the police officer asked me what my name was, I made up Scooter Jeanette. That was my favorite character on the Muppet Babies with Scooter. I felt as though I would get arrested if I told him my real name. My teachers, family, they all had to call me Scooter.
That's the sound of my space shuttle wasting all of your tax dollars.
But the only spaceship he was calling from was the Challenger because his phone call exploded.
Ah! Hashtag pulverize. Hashtag not too sharp.
I know my man Rome don't advocate violence, but if I saw you somewhere, I'd smack you with one of these Smashville catfish right in your face. I'd cut your damn cable off, partner.
Neil Young, what do you think they should do? It's your show. Bruce Springsteen, take it over. John Cougar Mellencamp. Joni Mitchell. Carol King.
Man, was she a hottie.
Cat Stevens, are you amongst us? Bob Myers.
Hey, Jim, anytime, man. I love talking to you. Love what you're about. Keep talking about San Quentin. You know, I'm going to keep asking you until you come. I mean, we don't really have a true relationship till we're behind maximum security. Then we can really form a bond.
And remember when Daniel LaRusso joined the Cobra Kai dojo and together they dominated the All-Valley Karate Championships for years and years?
Sweep the leg.
That's the guy calling out Durant? I haven't seen Tlaib shoot himself in the leg like that since, well, he shot himself in the leg. Hey-o!
Hey-o! Your typical Friday night where you steal singles out of your wife's purse, head to a
grip club in Hollywood and pay dudes to reenact the Toby and Keith.
Never happened. That's the problem with the smack off. That $5,000 cash prize brings out people like that. There's no way that guy's making the call otherwise.
Right in my face.
He flops and he whines and he moans and he bitches.
Boxing. Sports fighting. Let's just say we fight.
Step your game up.
I mean, as a kid, you loved circus, right? This is the adult version thereof. Lobster Boy. It's the bearded lady. Who doesn't like the circus?
Whoa.
Man, that sucked. Never again.
Give me back my
money from the event. And I'm into it. Because I know what it is. Rick Ankiel joins us.
Tell Daryl Kyle, hey, listen, thinking he'll get me a bottle of liquor and put it in a water bottle. He goes, look, I understand. You got to do what you got to do. I'll make it happen. And I pitched that game, Buzz, and I ended up beating Randy Johnson.
Hey. Steve Ballmer, on finding out that everybody would pay $150 a year to use Microsoft Word. His reaction.
Yeah!
Dude, orders up a shot of Jameson with a pickleback. And I'm like, oh, boy, here we go. He takes the shot, lands the pickleback. He goes,
this one's
for Mill. And he runs outside, and his minivan pulls up. He jumps in and speeds off.
Cigar aficionado.
Bob Sorrell.
Hashtag suck a chip.
Coming with me!
And this is the best phone call of the day.
This better not be my best phone call today.
Don't seem to be the sharpest people around.
Monster energy breath.
I'm going to send you back to Arkansas.
Enjoy the show. Take care. Have a great summer.
Class, I got to go.
Keep it pimping, homie.
Good night now!
Masterpiece Theater. Alvy, I need some more Niger. Oh, I got to go now.
Oh, I got to go.
Clones. Thank you very much for listening. Trust the podcast. Check back Monday for more Daily Jungle. We will see you then.
You know, I moved to Maine, Joe. You know, come on.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that. All right.